Welcome to All the Ways I've Failed. This podcast is recorded on the unceded lands of the Yugambeh people. We pay our respects to the traditional custodians and their continued connection to the land and sea on which we live, work and create. Hello there, my name is Beck Marshall-Say. I am a writer, an academic and the author of children's picture book Facing the Wave. All the Ways I've Failed is not only for writers but for anyone who creates, strives and fails along the way. Today I'm talking with Sarah Oakes. Sarah is a law professor and an author. Sarah teaches in the areas of legal method and communication and international criminal law. She has an extensive list of scholarly publications across a range of topics, including truth-telling in Indigenous justice, fake news and international criminal law, and law school hierarchy and power dynamics. Sarah is also the author of the thrilling murder mystery, The Dive, released in 2023. The Dive is slated for release in the US early 2024 under the title The Resort. Sarah, welcome to All the Ways I've Failed.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
So happy to be talking to you. I am really aware when I read out people's impressive CVs that there's no small amount of irony of starting a chat about failure with all the great things that we sort of put out into the world and that we've done.
It's so funny that you say that because we were just talking a little bit a while ago off camera about imposter syndrome. And as soon as you started reading that intro, my imposter syndrome was flaring. Like I did write those things. I don't know why I feel like that, but so I'm with you.
I think it's because those are the things you put out into the world, but you're aware of all the things that go behind that and the struggles and the mistakes and the things. And so when someone says you're all these amazing things, and you still are those things, it's just a more robust picture of what's sort of behind it, isn't it?
Yes, for sure. That intro doesn't cover, all of the drafts that did not make it to publication or anything like that. So that's, very true.
And I think this is anecdotally, and I should look it up. We tend to focus on that failure and things that have hurt us or upset us as a bit of an instinctive survival mechanism. And we're really incapable of holding onto those good things and sort of decorating our inner monologue with the good things. And we just remember the very bad, scary things, I think, to sort of go, stay away. Don't do that again. That was horrible.
Yes, absolutely. I feel like it's so easy to kind of skate over all of our successes and then just, I don't know what it is psychologically or what have you that make us focus on our failures so much more than our successes, but it's really easy to let the failures overshadow, all of the great things we've accomplished. So
absolutely. So before we dig into your thoughts on this anymore, what is one thing that your friends or family would say that you are categorically no good at, something you're destined to fail at?
Oh, okay. So I was actually thinking about this earlier and I'm in the process of buying a new home. I also am 7 months pregnant at the moment. So this one specific thing is really weighing on me. But I am terrible, and my family, my sister and my mother will be the first to tell you, I am terrible when it comes to things like interior decorating or anything related to like making your house look nice and presentable. Like, I don't know what it is. I feel like I've lost, like it skipped a gene.
I like that. Is it something that you are not good at? Do you get home and go, oh, that wasn't a good combination? Or is it just, you just don't even know where to start?
I don't even know where to start. And I honestly, I do try, I will say, to decorate, and then I'll set it up and I think it looks good. And then I will come home and be like, what? No, that's not nice. That does not look good. So I guess it's a little mix of both. I don't know where to start. And then when I do start, it's still a hot mess.
So before we get into a little bit more about those failures, can you tell me a little bit about The Dive? Because it is still pretty brand new. Who would enjoy reading The Dive?
Oh, that is a great question. So I think the Dive, I think really anybody who is interested in thrillers, suspense, murder mystery, and especially readers who enjoy those types of genres when they are set in kind of faraway tropical paradise settings and locations, I think that would be, that's kind of like my ideal reader. But The Dive is my debut thriller. It is a murder mystery that's set on the fictional Thai island of Koh Samui, which is very much kind of a backpacker scuba diving based island that's composed of a number of expats who have made it their home. And when a body is discovered during a scuba dive, it kind of threatens all of the secrets that the island holds and that these expats carry, and threatens to expose the real reasons why they left their lives back home and made their way to Thailand. So it's very exciting. It was my debut thriller. It came out in the UK and Australia, New Zealand in July of 2023. And like you said, it's coming out in the United States under a different title. It's called The Resort in the United States, and it'll be out February 6th. 2024.
Brilliant. And before the dive, so I understand you were quite inspired by a dive trip you took. Were you already a writer? Were you already writing and had aspirations of writing a novel before that? Or did the idea just come and you thought you'd have a go?
Yeah, absolutely not. I was not a writer really in any shape or form at the time that I took my trip to Thailand. So I actually traveled to Thailand in 2015. It was shortly after I had just graduated law school. I'd completed kind of a one-year temporary job for a judge on our federal courts. And I had about a month off between that position and when I was supposed to start as an attorney in a law firm. And I really was not looking forward to working in a law firm. It was kind of not where I was expecting my career path or trajectory to go. And I really just kind of needed an escape. And so I went with a couple friends to Thailand. We backpacked around for 2 weeks and we ended up down in the islands, specifically on an island called Koh Tao, which is known for its scuba diving. We became scuba diving certified there. And it was kind of one of those places that I absolutely fell head over heels for as soon as I stepped off the ferry. And it was, you know, I had mentioned I was not really that excited to start my new position. I was not excited to go home. And when I got home, all I could think about was this Paradise Island and wanting to go back there, and considered, you know, uprooting my whole life and moving back there and just kind of starting over. And what I should also mention, when I was there, I found out that the year before there had been a murder of two British tourists on the beach, very close to the hotel where I was staying in. And it was something that kind of struck me about the dichotomy between this absolutely heinous crime and this beautiful, beautiful island that I was living on that seemed so welcoming. And so that was kind of something that stuck in my head. So fast forward, I don't even know what 5 years, I suppose, to the pandemic. I had never really written anything before. I'd written a couple, you know, maybe short stories or something when I was in college for classes, but not anything that ever saw the light of day. I was an avid reader. I thought it would be really neat to write my own book, but I had no idea where to start. And like, who was I to think that I could just sit down and write a book? But you know, it was the pandemic and I literally had nothing else to do. So I was like, you know, I'll try this. And I researched it a lot. When I started writing, the first place that came to mind as a setting was the island of Koh Tao, this place that I had really not stopped thinking about for 5 years. And
got this idea, you've got the times popped up. How did you make that happen? Rather than, I guess, rabbit holing into, oh, I'm going to do a course and I'm going to do this research and I'm going to read 50 books about writing. Did you do some of that general research and start writing your book, or did you just jump straight in and sort of feel it out from there?
I'm a very impatient person. So I did a little bit of research. I read a couple books about how to structure a novel, which were very, very helpful. I didn't do any classes or anything like that. I really just kind of started writing. I had the setting, I had somewhat of a very mushy idea. And I was just thinking, you know what, I'm just going to write a couple scenes, see if anything comes from this, and then figure out how to kind of connect all of it as I go. And that's really what I did. So there wasn't a lot of kind of preparation prior to actually sitting down and writing. And a lot of it, I would say, I kind of learned as I went. So questions would pop up about, you know, style and structure and format and how to edit and things like that. And I would research them kind of as I got to that part of the writing process. But I have noticed, like I said, I'm very impatient. So I still, you know, I'm writing book two, I'm thinking about book three. And every time I start a new project, I strive to be one of those people that can kind of plot and outline the whole book and then sit down and have everything ready to go by the time it's writing time. But that's just, I can't do that. Like, I just kind of dive into the middle of things and then ultimately wait for it to become a finished product.
That's so much better though than sitting, I think, waiting for it to be fully formed in your head. I think the fact that you're prepared to dive in is amazing, because I know I've been crippled with that with my own writing, with some of my stories, and particularly with I also have a seedling of a sort of murder mystery idea, but because I can't see all the steps, I'm so scared to take the plunge. And how much of your, I guess, the twists and the turns and the knowing where it was going to end up, did you have in place early on, or was it a mystery to you for quite a bit of the writing process?
Yeah, I would say I had very little in mind when I started writing this. I had the setting. I knew fictional island based on Koh Tao for legal purposes. But I had the setting. I had the character, generally one, two, probably three characters that were fully kind of fleshed out, their motivations in mind. And that was really it. And so I had an idea for kind of some scenes and things I wanted to happen along the way. And that's where I started. But I don't think I didn't know the twists and turns for sure. And I don't think I even knew who the perpetrator was, I will say, until a couple chapters from the end of my first draft. So it was a lot of it, like you said, a lot of it was a mystery to me as I was writing it, which I think kind of makes it fun as well.
I think that's so encouraging. That's so wonderful. And because I think that's, again, what holds a lot of people back is that you're just so afraid, or that you're afraid of just investing your time and just finding that you've got nothing, that you've just written a load of someone walking around with a dead body and you never find out who did it.
It is an extremely daunting process. So I would say, I mean, my advice for anyone that's looking to write a book, like all of the books that I had read, the trade books that I'd read about how to successfully write a novel, they all talk about plotting and having an outline and making sure that you know where the story is going. And that just, I mean, it didn't work for me. I think if I had tried to follow that kind of plotting and preparation, I would never have written this book. I would have quit so many times. So I would say, yeah, it's really, you can read these advice books and you can read, you know, you can follow what other authors say, but at the end of the day, it's really just whatever works for you, whatever process gets the words down on the page and gets the story written. That's what you go for.
Do you feel, I guess, an increased sense of confidence going into book two? And you mentioned book three. We talked about imposter syndrome again a little bit on the record and a little bit before we started, or does that heighten that sense of pressure for you?
I was laughing when you asked, do you feel more confident? No, I feel probably less confident starting or working on book two than I did working on book one, because book one was really done in secret. I didn't tell anybody I was writing this book aside from my husband. And then I think a few months into the process, I told my mom and my sister, and they were the only people who knew. And it was just, I mean, that was kind of a way for me, if everything went belly up, no one would really know. I would just be a failure in my own mind, which is fine. There was a lot less, I suppose, pressure with the first book, because, you know, I had all the time in the world to write it. No one was asking for it, and I didn't know if anything was going to come from it. Book two has been a different beast entirely. I'm on a deadline. It's expected of me to produce. My publishers expect something that rises to the level of the dive, if not surpasses it. And there's just a lot more pressure, which has really, I found, affected my confidence. And on the issue of imposter syndrome, you know, I have such imposter syndrome in pretty much every aspect of my life. I've written about it. I've researched it. I just find it such kind of a fascinating phenomenon, especially because there are so many people who suffer from it, and people who you would never expect, which I find very interesting. But all that is to say, all my research and writing on it, I still suffer from it. I haven't found the cure. And I had that with book one, where I would just, you know, I compare myself to all of the other fabulous authors out there and have that thought of, you know, who am I to think that I can do what they do without any preparation or any kind of experience? And now with book two, not only am I comparing myself to all of these other wonderful authors out there, but now I'm comparing myself to myself from book one, if that makes sense, and wondering like, oh, well, I can never live up to what I did in book one. And it's just, I don't know, there's a lot. Clearly, I'm an overthinker and there's a lot of stuff going on in my brain. But I would say book two syndrome, I've heard, is a thing. It's very difficult to get through book two, in part because of that kind of mental block and all of those issues that arise from it. I'm definitely dealing with that at the moment.
Oh, people are wired fascinating way. The fact that you can't look at this and go, I've done this once, I can definitely do this again. There's people believing in me, and that we sit there and go, they're going to realize I'm terrible, and they're going to realize the first book was terrible, and it was it's all a mistake, and which is absolutely and categorically not true. I absolutely adored The Dive.
Thank you.
But I know I can completely sort of empathize with the thought process, which is just ridiculous that we do that to ourselves.
It is ridiculous. And I tell my family, I tell my husband, and they look at me like I'm crazy. Like, and they really, you know, they're great support, emotional support, mental support, all of that. But it is funny how we kind of get stuck in our own mindset and stuck in these kind of failure-oriented approaches to work and all of that.
So you haven't got a lengthy sort of amount of time, you know, puddling around in the world of writing and so on. You finished your first draft. What do you do with it next?
Yeah, so that's a great question. When I finished my first draft, I read through it. I edited it a few times. I didn't let anybody see it still because I was scared. And I knew I wanted it published. I knew I wanted it out in the world in some way, shape, or form. I put all this work into it and I didn't want it to just sit there. But I couldn't really work up the nerve to actually send it out to agents for representation. But thankfully, at the time, there was this Twitter contest called PitMad. And I don't think they have it anymore, which is very upsetting. But basically, how it worked was you tweeted out a very short blurb, a pitch for your book with the genre, and it would reach, you know, other readers, it would reach agents who are participating in it. And if the agent came across your pitch and wanted to know more, they would like the tweet. And I received a few likes from agents, which actually prompted me to send them my materials. And once I'd done that, I realized, you know, okay, well, these people are reading it, why not send it out more broadly? So then I sent it out to the agents, other agents who I was very interested in working with. After a few weeks, I would say maybe a month, I heard back and I ultimately decided to pursue representation with my current agent, Kate Burke, who is at Blake Friedman based in London. She's amazing. And from there, at that point, I was under the impression that once you secured an agent, you immediately submitted to publishers and your book was, you know, picked up and it would be a giant success and all of that stuff. That was not the case at all. That might be the case with some authors, but when I secured representation with Kate, she wanted to do several rounds of edits on The Dive, which made the book so much better. And I'm so, so glad that we did them and that we waited. But that, I would say, was probably the hardest part of that first round of structural edits from my agent, was the most difficult part of the entire writing process for The Dive. I ended up rewriting most of the book, I would say. And it was a months and months long process. I think I stayed with her for about a year, just working through rounds of edits before we ended up submitting it to publishers. And then when we submitted, in part thanks to those wonderful edits, it get snatched up by a UK publisher and by a US publisher and several foreign rights publishers as well. So that was very, very exciting.
You mentioned the editing process was quite challenging. How did you find responding to feedback, given that you have an academic background, you've submitted to journals and were you braced for that? Or is it always tricky?
It's always tricky. I mean, I'm used to a lot of feedback. constructive or not so constructive when it comes to my academic writing. I will say it's particularly weird in the United States how scholarly publications work, especially in the law school realm, because a lot of our academic works are submitted to what are called law reviews, which are journals that are edited and run by law students. So as, you know, law professors, you are submitting to students in their second and third year of law school who are not familiar at all with the material, but are still willing to say, this is not good and we do not want to publish it. So, you know, I think I've grown somewhat of a thick skin to that feedback. But when it came to fiction writing and to edit the edits on the dive, I mean, like I said, I didn't have experience as a fiction author before. So I was very, very open to what my agent and what my editors were suggesting, because I know they're the experts in this field and they know what works with readers. So I was very open to it. I will say it's kind of funny. And I realize I do the same thing when I'm giving feedback to my students in the law school courses that I teach. Usually when I get my edits back, my editors and my agent, they're lovely, lovely people to work with. So they'll always open it up with something really nice to say, you know, this book is amazing. I loved everything about it. Now please find attached an 11-page single space document that basically will have you rewrite the entire book. So when it comes to edits, I usually need to sit with them for a couple weeks maybe before I actually get started on them, because it can be really overwhelming. And even when I'm reading through, you know, the editorial letter, the notes that I receive that kind of outline what should be changed, I find I usually have to stand up and take a break after every page or every paragraph or something and just kind of step away from it and then come back and reorient myself with it. Because it can be a lot, but it's at the end of the day, I mean, these people are, they're not just tearing apart your work for no reason. They want to make it better. And it does. The edits that I've received do make my work so, so much better in the end.
I always find that I have to have a quick glance and overview and see what's the worst thing they've said. I want to see what the really bad things are. And then I sort of have to like close it and not look. And then I can go back. And like you said, usually put a little bit of time. Fortunately, with the sort of length of work I'd been doing with submissions with picture books and some essays, but it's 24 hours is usually enough for me. It's not 11 pages, so I don't need a few weeks, but I need a solid 24 hours. And I usually tell, you know, my partner or my family, like, oh, I've just got some feedback and I feel a bit weird and I don't really want to talk about it. And the next day you feel much better.
Yes.
So your book is inspired by travel, and travel is something that perhaps, much like writing or anything we do, it looks amazing and it looks glamorous, and in reality it is amazing, but it's also very uncomfortable and there's lots of fails and flops. Have you had any big travel days or any big standouts where you go, oh, that was a big fail?
Yeah, I've had many of those. First of all, I love how you say that. You know, it does, especially when you're posting on Instagram and on social media, it's so, you only post the highlights, of course. So everyone's travel just looks so majestic and wonderful. And you know, it's designed to make people jealous. Even when I look back at some of kind of the things I've posted from some of my trips, it's so easy to gloss over all of the, you know, flight delays or all of the issues with checking in or everything that went wrong, because none of that sees the light of day on social media. It's only the good stuff. But yeah, I would say I've had a lot of travel fails, but specifically with my Thailand trip back in 2015, the first night we arrived, we were in Bangkok and we went to, I can't even remember what the name of it was, but it was the road that's designed for backpackers and tourists, where it's like a lot of seedy establishments where the Hangover 2 or Hangover 3 was filmed. And we met some really kind of seedy people. And I'm pretty sure I was with a guy friend of mine, thank goodness, who took very good care of me, but they put something in my drink, which was very, very scary. and it wasn't a roofie. It was something I don't even know, but my mind went to like all crazy places. My friend took care of me. And then after that, I had the worst hangover. Thank God nothing happened. We were safe. We got back to the hotel, but I probably had a hangover for 3 days after that, which was horrible. And if you are going to be hungover from anything in Bangkok, it's not a great experience because there's just so much kind of sensory overload everywhere between the lights and the smells and everything. So that was a rough start to the Thailand trip, but it ended up being lovely. And we also, we hadn't started our careers yet. So we were backpackers and we were trying to do everything very cheap. And we ended up booking a flight the wrong way around the world. So rather than going from, we were in New Orleans at the time, rather than going from New Orleans west through California and then through Asia, we ended up flying from New Orleans to Houston to Moscow to Singapore and then to Bangkok. So I think we traveled probably 3 full days just to get there. And there was all sorts of issues. I had a lot of embarrassing and weird travel moments, I would say.
When I was on exchange to Germany at high school, and we missed a plane and got stuck in Malaysia for a week. And then my travel failure histories happened from there. But when I did my dive trip to Thailand, I was traveling with a girlfriend and we had been up north and we were coming back to Bangkok, and we got in this taxi and drove, I'm pretty sure, a big loop around the city back to pretty close to the Hua Lumpong station. And they pulled into this back street and they said, this is your address. There's no hotel where we... where we were meant to be. And I was still back then too sort of cheap to have anything on my mobile. So I was just like, oh, well, I guess we'll try and find a payphone because we don't have international roaming on. Yeah. And there was nothing. And I had my friend, because all our bags were in this taxi. And I said to my friend Gemma, I said, stay in the car, leave the door open, but don't get out because our bags are in it. You need to be half in, half out so they can't drive off with our bags. And rang this number, and it was a home number. So then we went back to the taxi and I said, this street, take us back to this street. We'd seen a McDonald's and a big street not too far, and they refused to take us back. So then we got turfed out in this back, just, I don't know, quiet little dingy dark area.
Oh my gosh.
Found a tuk-tuk, got back to McDonald's again because we had been too sort of cheap for roaming and things, and it wasn't as prevalent back then. We had an old, hard copy travel guide, and we're like, we'll go to this place. We'll go to this area. It looks like there's a few hotels that are to our budget. Yeah. And then again, we couldn't get a taxi, and an Australian expat managed to get us in a tuk-tuk with all our stuff. And it was pretty bad, but it was okay.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things, again, in hindsight, you go, oh, well, that was really not the worst thing that could have happened, but.
No, but there is also, I feel like now that I'm, in my 30s, looking back at some of the things I've done when I've traveled, especially in my, early mid-20s, I'm like, how did I survive? What was I possibly thinking during these times? But it's funny. I mean, and they make for good stories now, but thank goodness nothing worse happened.
Absolutely. I was with my now husband, and I once convinced him in Finland to get into a van so someone could take us to a CrossFit gym. And I said, it's fine. And we got in the van and there was nothing in the back. I said, he's got nice eyes, it's fine. And all these things that you, your practical brain, if it was just you traveling by yourself, it was like, no, I'm not doing that. I'm like, it's fine. It's snowing. We're very cold. We need the lift. It will be fine. Stop fussing.
The Finns are pretty trustworthy, right?
That's right. I'm sure nothing horrible ever happens there. What could go wrong? Travel's one of those things that I think makes you particularly vulnerable to failure, because you have high expectations. You are out of your comfort zone. You are tired. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, you probably don't have very much money to just mm-hmm. roll with things and to do things that you would at home. You go, we'll just book this. We'll just get this really fancy hotel right here. You go, no, you know what? We're going to trek in a tuk-tuk across town to this dingy place where I have to tie my sleeping bag liner up around my neck because I'm really worried about the bedding. Whereas if you were at home,
you just got my kind of memories rolling. I have stayed in some very interesting places over the years.
You love travel. It's definitely inspired the dive. Without giving away too much, will that inform your upcoming stories?
Yes, absolutely. So I studied abroad in Australia. And while I was there, I was based in Melbourne. When I was there, I did a 2-week spring break trip with a bunch of the people I studied abroad with. And it went up to Cairns and the Whitsunday Islands. And it was very adventure themed, scuba diving and skydiving and bungee jumping and whitewater rafting, all of these wonderful things. And it was really kind of something that really shaped my whole experience in Australia. So that actually serves as the inspiration for my book 2, which is a study abroad focused thriller that is set in Australia. It starts in Sydney, goes to Cairns, goes to the Whitsundays, and then ends up in the Outback. But essentially the working plot for that is it's broken into 2 different timelines. So the past timeline looks at this group of, you know, students who really formed very quick friendships while studying abroad. At the end of their program, one of them goes missing. And then the second timeline is fast forward 10 years once they've all left and returned to their lives. The student who went missing, her body is discovered in the middle of the Outback, and it causes all of these people to return and really kind of retrace their steps and figure out exactly what happened to this missing girl who ended up murdered. So it's very much drawn from my own experiences in Australia, and I don't have any concrete details for future books, but I have kind of a list of settings in mind based on the places that I have traveled, and especially the places that have really kind of shaped me as a traveler and a person, and those trips that really left an impact and that I want to kind of revisit.
I love that you were talking about the difficulty of second book syndrome and that you've decided to add 2 timelines in just to make that even more of a challenge. You go, how can I make this really, really complicated? I know what I'm going to do.
I am a glutton for punishment. I think with the dive, one of the biggest issues I had, I mean, as you know, it's a dual narrator. It has 2 separate narrators in the dive. And one thing I struggled with my UK editor specifically was trying to make the voices of those 2 female narrators distinct, which was very, very difficult for me. And we worked on it through rounds and rounds of edits. And I said, never again am I having 2 narrators. And then as soon as I started book 2, I had the dual timelines and I had to end up with 2 separate female narrators. And now I'm having the exact same issue. I told my editor and he was like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this to yourself? So yeah, glutton for punishment.
Going into your next book, is there anything about the writing process that you would just chuck out, or anything that you found worked really well that you would keep moving forward? What were your lessons learned?
Oh, that's great. I think one of the big lessons, I kind of touched on this before, was when I started writing, after reading all of those kind of advice books on, you know, how to successfully write a novel, I found I was trying to follow the advice that I'd read online and in those books, which involved, you know, heavily plotting and having the full plot and the twists and turns kind of mapped out. And it took me a while to realize that wasn't for me. And I think I could have saved a lot of time with the dive if I just kind of embraced my own very chaotic approach to writing. And again, when it came to book 2, I found I was doing the same thing. I said, it'll be a lot more streamlined this time if I can just start with, you know, a full outline. And I spent maybe, you know, a couple weeks really trying to think through everything and come up with a plot until I realized it's not working for me. I went back to the way I wrote the dive, and here we are. So I think with book 3 and with future books, I'm going to you know, take everyone's advice with a grain of salt about how they approach their writing. But no, at this point, this is the process that works for me. I'm not going to try to change it just to match, you know, other people's expectations or how they work best. And I'm going to kind of embrace it. So I would say that was a big lesson learned.
And for a lot of writers, once you get the book contract, you think that's the dream. I'll get the book and everything's going to be okay. And everyone says it's tricky afterwards, but it's not tricky. It'll be fine. That's all I need. What about lessons learned in terms of that, the business of becoming a writer that happens once you step into the publishing and the promotional process?
Yeah, I think something I really didn't know when I kind of started on this journey was that as an author and as a published author especially, you aren't just a writer. like being an author encompasses a ton of different jobs that I have never trained for and don't know anything about. So in addition to just, you know, writing and editing your book, you also carry a lot of the weight when it comes to promotion. And self-promotion is something that is scary to me and I'm not necessarily great at. I had to become very familiar with social media, which is something that is not really in my wheelhouse. And yeah, it's just, and also writing, you know, op-eds or essays to help promote your book. There was just a lot of aspects to kind of the publication process that I wasn't aware of and aren't highly publicized when I was kind of getting into this. And I will also say a lot of the time, something that's kind of difficult is there's not a lot of transparency when it comes to kind of what's going on behind the scenes with your publishers. So a lot of the time, like I, for instance, I just got really great news about the publication of The Resort that I unfortunately cannot share yet, but I wasn't even aware that was something to be considered. So a lot of it, you know, you can end up with really nice surprises with some stuff, but at the same time, there's, you as an author don't always know exactly what's going on behind the scenes.
That's very true. I've certainly experienced that with my my book got sold overseas to US, sort of an educational publisher, which was wonderful. But you go, oh,
congratulations.
Oh, wow. Oh, thank you. And you go, what? Oh, what does this mean? And then you're a bit worried to ask people because you don't want to be a burden or you don't want
yes.
to.
Or look stupid.
Something that you think maybe you should know.
Yes.
And then again, imposter syndrome, you go, well, a real writer would know what was going on.
Exactly. We want to talk about kind of the peak of imposter syndrome and not really knowing what you're doing as an author. I had to sign, it's been a while since I've signed books because the Dive isn't available in the United States. So I haven't really had many copies to sign. So I had to, back in Sweden, one of my relatives wanted the Dive as a gift. So I was going to sign the book for her. And then I just had this complete mental lapse and I could not remember for the life of me what page you actually sign of the book, because there's kind of two title pages, one that has more information than the other. So I had to Google, you know, as an author, what page do you sign? And I was like, this is a low point here.
I went to a bookshop for a reading and I spent way too much time agonizing on whether I should take my own pen or not. Does this look presumptuous?
Oh, that's, yes. Okay, so I'm glad I'm not the only one that has these, you know, these issues going through their head.
And I think we all just suffer in silence. And again, you just, and who, there's no one watching is the other thing. There's no one sitting on the sidelines who cares that much to have an opinion on where you sign it, which type of pen you use, whether you brought your own pen, because in the eyes of everyone else as well, you're a real author. But to yourself, you just happen to fluke getting a book published.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right.
So we've talked about a lot of the scary things or the hiccups or the things that were tough in the publishing process. What were the real highlights, those moments, whether it was finishing the draft or something that happened or seeing your book in a particular space that made you really just feel completely joyful about what you were doing?
The way I've kind of described this, I have been focusing on all of the drawbacks and the weird stuff that I've encountered, but the publication process has been so incredible. And meeting all of these people who are so excited about your book, like the people who are working on it, the readers, people connecting over Instagram like we did, it's been, the whole process is kind of mind-blowing when you think about it. It's been really, really cool. I think the hands down, the best experience I've had so far was over the summer. I went to London to meet my agent for the first time. We'd never actually met face to face because I was based in the US and then in Sweden, and she was based in London, and to meet my editor and the publication team at Transworld, which is my UK publisher. And while we were there, I went with my editor and my publicist around the whole city and delivered proofs of the dive to all of these various bookstores. We had a lunch with journalists to talk about the dive. And then I ended up going to the Transworld offices, where they had this really lovely kind of champagne toast for me. And everyone was coming up and talking about how much they enjoyed working on the dive and how much they enjoyed reading it. And that was just, I would never have predicted that any of that would happen a couple of years ago. That was totally off my radar. And it was something that I was kind of like flying high on for months to follow. It was just really kind of a surreal pinch myself week.
And Sarah, where can people find you if they want to connect with you, if they want to be kept abreast of, you know, updates as your next book arrives or future releases?
Yeah, so my website is sarahoaksauthor.com, and I'm also, the social media site I'm probably most active on is Instagram, and my handle is at sarahoaksauthor there. So I would love to connect with anybody who's interested in my writing journey or travel journey or, you know, future baby journey, whatever the case may be. Yeah, I look forward to connecting.
Sarah, thank you so much for your time, and I can't wait to read your next book.
Thank you so much. I've loved being here.
Thank you for listening to All the Ways I've Failed. You can find details about our guests and their work in the show notes, and you can find me on Instagram at All the Ways I've Failed or at Beck Marshall Say. Please rate and review wherever you listen to podcasts so that others can hear the beautiful and generous stories of our wonderful guests.